I've lost the meaning of my life and I have no one to turn to.
You have me to turn to, now. Life is harsh, but you are young, Mrs. Casaubon, and blooming. And he is not master of his feelings in this crisis. I think when the commonplace, we must all die, changes suddenly into, I must die and soon, then death grapples us, and his fingers are cruel. Fear can make cowards of us all, my dear young friend. Forgive him and have pity. I know you can do this. You have greatness in you.
Edward?
Who's there? Dorothea? It's so late. Were you waiting for me? Come, my dear, come. You are young and need not to extend your life by watching.
In Middlemarch by George Eliot, we heard Caroline Martin, Robert Glenister, Nick Fletcher and Tom Goodman Hill, with Laura Doddington, Carl Johnson, Roger Allam, Candida Benson, Nicholas Murchie, Sally Dexter and Richard Delane. It was dramatised by Judith Adams and the producer was Gaynor McFarlane. And next time, Dorothea gets a surprise and the chance to help. Middlemarch continues all next week at 2.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Tark is enjoying a nice bask in the sun when along comes a pack of hounds and a nightmare chase is on. Tark of the Otter concludes in 15 minutes. But first, Dominic West reads the second part of David Kynaston's intimate story of Britain in the 1950s, Family Britain, which draws on the letters, diaries and memories of well-known and ordinary people. Today, the core values of family and society begin to fray at the edges.
Deference, respectability, conformity, restraint, trust. The world of the 1950s really was a different world. One at its best evoked by S. Hickson, a prudential agent, the man from the Prue, servicing the market gardeners and bulb growers of Spalding in Lincolnshire.
There was always a place set for me at lunch, and I can still see those heaped plates of steamed apple puddings, followed by an equally generous plate of meat, often home-cured bacon and vegetables. Then there were the places I used to get the key, in the spout over the kitchen window, under a piece of brick near the side door, on a nail in the shed. And then I would let myself into the house and find the books and premiums which had been left in some convenient place. Many times I would also find a hastily scribbled note. Please take an extra sixpence and post these letters. Fill in this form. Tell the doctor Johnny is not so well. Tell my mother I cannot get home this week. And leave this parcel at Mrs. Brown's, and many others of the like sort.
But the playwright David Hare, who grew up in Bexhill-on-Sea, has very different memories of the decade.
I think anyone who wants to return to Britain in the 50s is on to an insane project. The society was so oppressive and so false, particularly sexually. Neighbours had this prurience and primness and this awful kind of policing of each other's lives. Nobody could now imagine how dull things were and how respectful people were and how dead they were from the neck up.
Blending in, not standing out, was the order of the day. The novelist Barry Unsworth remembers his childhood in Stockton-on-Tees.
It was certainly not a place in those days for much deviation from a pretty dour norm, let alone for anything in the nature of artistic affectation. To carry an umbrella or ask for wine in a pub was to put your virility in question. Suede shoes were for lounge lizards. Beards were out of the question.
So not much, apart from the Monday washing, was yet being hung out. Life in London, even in the most crowded streets, seemed like a film of pre-talkie days, recorded the Indian writer Neeraj Chowdhury about his visit to England in 1955.
I had an uncanny sensation when I saw unending streams of people going along Oxford Street and heard no sound. As they moved into the underground stations, they looked like long lines of ants going into their hole. He met the same silence in pubs, restaurants, and buses. The desire to fit in, to be respectable, was made manifest in family life. Marriage itself was the unassailable norm. By the mid-1950s, 96% of women would marry before the age of 50. And once in a marriage, there was very little hope of getting out. Divorce was highly unusual throughout the decade, running at an annual rate of around 2 divorces per 1,000 married people. For wives, there were competing messages. Officially, this was the dawning age of the companionable, shared interests, no separate spheres marriage, as ordained in 1949 by the Royal Commission on Population, with its manifest approval for the wife's role as companion to her husband, as well as a producer of children. Yet equally powerful, arguably more powerful, was the discourse stressing that good companions did not mean equal companions. "Don't try to be the boss," warned Monica Dickens in her Woman's Own column in 1955, as she attacked the slightly abnormal woman who wants to have her cake and eat it. In other words, she wants a man to give her love, companionship, a home, children, and the wherewithal to support life comfortably, but she cannot bring herself to let her man be the head of the household. It was the same in the marriage bed, at least as laid down by Dr. Mary Macaulay's The Art of Marriage, first published in 1952. Not only was the success of the erotic side of the marriage chiefly the husband's responsibility, but it was a shocking thing to hear of a wife refusing her husband's sexual advances, in that such an attitude would be impossible in any woman to whom loving and giving were synonymous. How to Dress to Please Men was the expressive title of a series in Every Woman in the early 1950s, with a special emphasis on personal grooming. "He likes you to be soft and silky." Other women's magazines relentlessly pushed the ideal, indeed the indispensability, of feminine physical attractiveness. Woman's Own, in 1951, didn't mince its words.
"She won't get far without polishing up her good points and disguising her bad ones, so that he's completely befogged by glamour. It's at this stage that the romantic compliments are paid and the diamond engagement rings get shopped for."
The perfect partner was also the perfect homemaker. Not least in the context of the enhanced prestige of the housewife in the eyes of the newly servantless middle class. It was a role played out above all in the kitchen. "A woman's place?" almost needlessly asked Woman's Own.
"Yes, it is, for it is the heart and centre of the meaning of home. The place where, day after day, you make with your hands the gifts of love."
And television ads for washing powder unashamedly equated the moral worth of the wife with the whiteness of her husband's shirts. Yet however exalted, a housewife did not exist on the same plane as a mother. And one figure above all was identified with promotion of the idealized mother, the psychoanalyst John Bowlby. Throughout the early 1950s, he relentlessly and brilliantly propagated his research findings about the crucial influence of mother love on the formation of a child's character and personality. Typical was his conclusion to a News Chronicle article, bluntly headed, "The Mother Who Stays at Home Gives Her Children a Better Chance," in 1952.
"Babies need mothers because a child's emotional development depends on his relationship with his mother in his very early years. If she neglects him when he is small, there will be trouble afterwards. So the mother who stays at home is giving her children a surer foundation for mental health than costly equipment and an expensive education can provide. Research shows that the deprived children of today are the delinquents and neurotics of tomorrow."
And in The Education of Girls, John Newsom, Chief Education Officer for Hertfordshire, another figure of the male establishment, set out his views.
The future of women's education lies not in attempting to iron out their differences from men, to reduce them to neuters, but to teach girls how to grow into women and relearn the graces which so many have forgotten in the last 30 years.
As for higher education, growing steadily if not yet spectacularly, by 1958 female students still comprised only 24% of the whole university intake, exactly the same as back in 1920. But despite the huge moral and social pressures, the 1950s were not entirely bereft of ambitious, independent-minded women. Sheila Van Damme was a leading long-distance rally driver before she retired in 1956 to run the Windmill Theatre. And Rose Heilbronn became a household name as one of the outstanding defence barristers of the era, specialising in high-profile murder trials. One determined woman, though, remained thwarted for most of the decade. In late 1954, having twice fought unwinnable seats in nearby Dartford, Margaret Thatcher sought to secure the Tory nomination for the eminently winnable Orpington. She failed, largely, it seems, because leading local Tories believed her candidacy would be incompatible with having two small children. A bitterly disappointed Thatcher wrote to Central Office in early 1955 that accordingly she would abandon further thought of a parliamentary career for many years. Of course, women's magazines knew that many women did work, but the prescribed life pattern they tended to assume and foster was school, job, job and marriage, and then childcare and full-time domesticity, followed perhaps by later return to part-time employment. The status of female paid work remained low. With no overall equal pay legislation, average female wages were running at only 59% of men's, and the prevailing assumption was that women worked for pin money, not a living wage in its own right. In 1957, the government's Mass Observation Project interviewed full-time housewives, of whom 53% said that they would not like a job, with no one to look after the children easily the main reason given. But 47% said they would like a job. This wistful 30-year-old middle-class mother of two was typical.
Oh, it would be smashing to get a break. Getting away from the housework and the children just for a short time each day. Everything is the same, day after day.
The monotony of most housewives' lives was revealed in a mass observation survey involving 700 London working-class women. They kept daily diaries for a week, which revealed that their average weekday was one of at least 15 hours. Just listening to an account of a typical morning is exhausting.
Forenoon. Got up, washed, cooked a night breakfast, dressed baby, cleared breakfast, tidied and swept nursery, made children's beds, put baby out in pram, got dressed myself, made own bed, tidied bedroom, tidied bathroom, cleaned basin, polished floor, cleaned out grate, tidied living room, tidied kitchen, washed up breakfast, laundry, hung out washing, took out rubbish, brought in coal, went out to shop, more laundry, started to cook lunch.
As mass observation observed about the housewife generally, much of her day may be spent in total isolation from adults. Ken Blakemore's memoir, Sunnyside Down, about growing up in the Cheshire village of Bunbury, paints a touchingly authentic portrait of his mother, a typical 1950s housewife. He says that she was basically cheerful and had an infectious laugh, but there was no mistaking the fact that, as the 1950s went on, eddies of discontent sometimes swirled into her moods. Blakemore adds that generally, in terms of the domestic economy, there were two big flies in the ointment for his mother. The first was the increasingly inadequate housekeeping money.
Dad left a certain amount of money on top of the bureau in the kitchen every week. He seemed to assume that Mum would discover it, with a little cry of pleasure and surprise as she went about her dusting. The actual amount that was needed to cover the cost of the week's groceries, coal and milk, was never discussed, On Planet Dad, it seemed that a full catering and fuel supply service could be obtained by leaving a modest amount of cash like this under an old butter dish.
The other problem was boredom with household chores. Blakemore quotes her remark to him in the 1970s, after his father had died.
At last, no more cooking. I can eat what I really like. Sandwiches.
Dominic West reading part two of Family Britain by David Kynaston. It featured the voices of Madeline Brawley, Emily Bevan, Matt Fraser and Nigel Coombs. The producer was Jane Greenwood. Now, if you've been following the whole Matt, Lillian, Paul thing in The Archers, you won't want to miss this.
Ambridge Extra returns to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
He was the most wonderful, kind-hearted man I've ever met. Then there were misunderstandings.
I'm sorry.
I got angry. And then he was gone.
The story continues as Matt and Lillian face the truth.
Oh, never mind. Let's just forget it.
What?
Well, you're clearly hating every minute of this.
What are you talking about?
Doesn't matter.
Ambridge Extra begins Tuesday afternoon at 2:15.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
In a quarter of an hour, Adam Nicholson has to convince his workers to back the garden's return to a working landscape in the final part of his memoir about his childhood home, Sissinghurst. But first, it's time for the fifth and final episode of Tarka the Otter. Yesterday, White Tip gave birth to Tarka's cubs, and we left Tarka dreaming sweet dreams. But he's soon in for a rude awakening. The reader is Nicholas Farrell.
At 10:30 in the morning, a covered motor van stopped at the bridge below the dark pool. From the driver's seat, three men got down, and at the sound of their footfalls, deep notes came from the van. Hearing the hounds, the two terriers, Biff and Bite'em, held by a girl in a jacket of rough blue serge, yapped and strained against the chain. Motor cars were drawn up on one side of the road. The men, women and children who had come to the meet of otterhounds stood by them and talked or lounged against the stone parapets of the bridge. Faces turned to the hound van, and there, Deadlock, his black head scarred with old fights, sat on his haunches, apart and morose, watching for the yellow waistcoat of the master. His right ear showed the mark made by the teeth of Tarka's mother 2 years before, when he had thrust his head into the hollow of the fallen tree. Shortly after 10:30, the hounds and two terriers, nearly throttling themselves in their eagerness to press forward, were trotting behind the huntsman through the farmyard to the river. They jumped down the bank, leaping across the shallows to the left bank, and working upstream to the occasional toot of the horn. Almost at once, Deadlock whimpered and bounded ahead. Tarka had touched there on the stones 6 hours before. The dark green weeds were bending and swayed silently by the slow glide of the water. The leat had been dug to carry water to the elm wheels of the two mills by the bridge a mile below. Tarka swam through the dark green swaying weed and over the dark brown bed. When he swung up to breathe, his nose showed in the ripple like a dead leaf turned up the current and settling down again. He swam under the heavy oaken fender, which was raised to let the water through. A trout darted by him as he passed under the fender, and he caught it with a sudden turn of his body. Sometimes a swift, cutting the air with alternate strokes of its narrow black wings, dashed a ripple as it sipped and sped on. A chiff-chaff sang its two-note song. By a briar raking the water, the otter's head was raised. He listened and swam to the bank. Hounds spoke remotely. He knew Deadlock's tongue among them. He climbed out of the leat, the trout still in his mouth, and pushed through the undergrowth among nettles and marshwort and over soft, damp ground. Robins ticked at him. Wrens stittered. He ran in a loop back to the leat, and slipped into the water above the hounds, who had gone down. He swam up for a quarter of a mile, then rested by an alder root and listened to the pack running over his land trail. Hearing Deadlock's tongue, he lay still. He felt no fear. All his energy was in listening. Chiff-chaff, chiff-chaff, sang the bird among the ash trees. And soon, the voices of men, the tearing of brambles against coats, boots trampling and snapping the hollow green stalks of hogweed and hemlock. Tarka saw their heads and shoulders against the sky and swam on up the leat. Tally-ho! Tarka turned and went down the leat again. He reached water deep enough to cover him before he met the hounds, who, hunting by sense of smell, did not see him moving as a dark brown shadow through the channels in the weeds. Hounds passed him, for the wash or scent on the water was still coming down. Tarka turned.